Hello, and welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
And I'm Rhonda.
Hello, Rhonda.
Hi, Frank. How's it going?
It's good, I guess. Yeah. It's going well. I mean, we're sort of both under construction. We've talked about before we came on, like, there's might be construction noise in the back, but
yeah, there may be a few drills
in your apartment. Hammering. And I'm in the library because it's under renovation. But that said, on the way here, my apartment building, you know, which is half empty, a lot of doors were open and there were workers, like, you know, fixing up the apartments because they're empty.
Wow.
I've never seen so many vacancies. And then the other thing, on the way here, my favorite coffee place, like a local family-run coffee place, after 10 years is leaving.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. He said, he had a 10-year lease, I just found out today. And he said, I guess it was perfect timing. The lease is up and retail is not doing so well as it used to be. And they were doing like a 2-for-1 food thing. And, you know, so a lot of change, shall we say. And the neighborhood is changing. And, you know, my library is still closed for the renovation reasons. And I look forward to reopening it. And I have some plans for sort of a street side thing that I can tell you about later. But just to sort of be a part of the community, like so many of these places that are closing or struggling.
Oh my God. I know. Yeah. And it's just interesting, like you said, to see all the empty apartments, you know, like what's happening.
And the rents have been driven down for sure. Which is also unusual, but I don't know. We'll see. Change.
Exactly.
You know, leads us to a very...
Exactly.
Quickly just to the book. I mean,
perfect transition. The focus of change.
We read Octavia Butler's The Parable of the Sower, as many of you listening have also read, I hope. So we'll talk about it free and wild with spoilers galore. But it's interesting that we did choose this book because I wasn't aware until recently that Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, which we read, had reappeared on the bestseller list a couple of months ago. And it's now that I've read it, which I had no idea, which I love going into it. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know what it would be. I had a feeling it was science fiction-y because it was, I think, cataloged as science fiction in the New York Public Library. But, you know, that could be very elastic, as we'll talk about. But that, you know, along with like 1984 and Handmaid's Tale, Parable of the Sower was another book that people are looking to as something reflective of what's happening in our world today, which we could see if that's true or not. But it definitely had a resurgence because it was written in 1993.
Right.
And apparently is there's a sequel, a part two.
Parable of the Talents.
Exactly, which I didn't know either. And I did find out that Octavia Butler was writing a third to make it a trilogy. Didn't get it, you know, worked on it for years, and Octavia Butler passed away in 2006, I believe.
Right.
But Parable of the Sower, it was 1993, and Parable of the Talents, 1998. So Parable of the Sower.
I know. And actually, speaking of science fiction, I've read everything by Octavia Butler, and this is probably the least what most people would think of as kind of science fiction. I mean, this is definitely kind of like dystopian, and at the time was, you know, in the future, but she has some fiction that is what people would really think of as like science fiction, you know, aliens and outer space and things like that. So in terms of that, you know, if people are kind of turned off by the idea of science fiction, I feel like this is her least, you know, kind of one like that would fall into what most people think of as that category.
Yeah, because I, you know, I don't resist. Well, I don't gravitate towards science fiction. And so I was excited to read it because I was like, oh, I'll get into a science fiction book and see what it's all about. But I agree with you. When I was reading it, I was like, it's not really science fiction as I think of it, which you could, again, change what science fiction means. And other people out there would probably educate me well on that. Mm-hmm. It was fiction and literary fiction at that. And because there aren't, like you said, aliens and things like that. It's an idea book, really. An almost what if book, which is also science fiction. But more what if ideologically things had changed and how would one navigate that new world? Not so much aliens and robots, but ideas and governing and change in society.
And I guess you could take the concept, and we'll get into this, the whole kind of foundation of her, or the goal of her new, I guess you could call it religion, Earthseed, is to kind of go to outer space. So in that sense, you could call it, you know, you could add the science fiction elements. And I won't talk too much about the second book, but that does play more of a role in the second, in the Parable of the Talents.
Well, I wouldn't talk at all about the second book, and if you can help it, but
I won't. It's hard not to, though. I do have to say, it's hard not to.
I know.
Because it does bring it full circle.
Okay.
I did not know she was writing a third, so I would be really interested to read more about that, because I felt the second one wrapped it up pretty good. But okay, no more about Parable of the Talents.
Well, no, I mean, please, far be it for me to squash that. But, you know, I'm just half joking. Yeah, the third one was Parable of the Trickster.
Oh, I did hear about that. That's interesting. Yeah.
But you know what I do? I do like that Parable of the Sower does seem self-contained. It's not like you have to read the next one, and it's not like eight books in the series.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like she definitely wrote it. I don't know if she intended to write a trilogy or she was doing one at a time and then it materialized as she was, but it's a very self-contained book. You're not left on a precipice that you have to read the second one to say, what's going on here?
I agree with you, but if you read the second book like I did and you come back and you reread the first book, you do see how both parts of the story are really important. So I'm saying, I hope you read the second book.
Because the
character that we'll talk about, Lauren Olamina, who is the main character of the story and who's telling it to us through her diary, she does continue to grow as a character through this book and through the second book. So I'll leave it at that.
All I'm saying, Rhonda, is that I'd hope Octavia Butler would write a sequel that would be as interesting as the first one. I'm just saying that having not read the second one, the first one felt like a full-fledged work. You know what I mean? It didn't require or beg for a sequel per se, unless you really wanted it, which I could totally get into. Which, you know, I don't love series, but like I love the idea that she continued this world. So I'm just saying that the first book could, like in 1995, before the second was written, it could have been, yes, that was a standalone modern day classic almost. I guess I'm just worrying this issue to death. But you were about to actually sort of say, give a little recap, it looked like.
Are we giving a recap?
You want to?
We can, sure. So basically this is, you can help me out here too. We are reading it's written in diary form. And so the story is being told to us through the diary of Lauren Olamina, and it takes place, which to me, you know, I forgot that it took place so close to like the time that we're in now.
Yeah.
But between 2024 and 2027. And the world, the United States at this time, has just completely fallen into chaos, destruction. You know, she lives in this community that's inside of this wall, which apparently most neighborhoods to keep safe are inside of this wall, because the outside of these walls, again, like it's just, you know, poverty and people are driven to cannibalism and there's no more real education and there's a cholera outbreak and constant violence. And so just, you know, you can't go out alone. You have to go out in groups, and and even the climate and environment has changed. You know, it hasn't rained for 6 or 7 years. So that's the kind of world that she's living in. And I guess, you know, because of this, you know, she begins to kind of think about her idea, her concept of God, and what is God to her, and begins to kind of develop her own religion called Earthseed with the premise. So that's of change. So that's kind of just like a really quick.
Yeah, that's the launching pad for the book. I mean, she's living in California, mm-hmm. and in a community that might have been once a gated community. Mm-hmm. But it definitely has a wall around it, about 11 households in that community. And the environment has changed and is changing. The government is basically getting smaller, but more corporatized, in that they're almost, with the corporations are buying towns and, to, you know, inviting people to work in those towns, but basically not paying them enough to survive. So they're always in debt to their corporation that they live in. So it's a perpetual vicious circle of not making enough to survive and always being in debt to your corporate employer that owns the town you live in, which is basically a form of slavery, debt slavery. There's a new president, which I know figures in the second book, but who sort of is merging government and religion, which is another reason why Lauren is questioning her own religious upbringing. Her father is a minister, a preacher of Christianity. It's not really blatantly, is it blatantly said about Christianity? Not really. I mean, she's sort of, you can assume it, but she's sort
of. Yeah, I think you can assume
that her upbringing is based in that religion, of course. And she's not really rejecting it. She's almost like, well, planting a seed in that basis and growing out of it.
Right.
You could say. She's 15 and pretty smart. I mean, pretty admirable. She has qualities that I wish I had. So yes, there's this chaos, and there's also a drug in the world called Pyro. And it makes people set things on fire, which the watching of the fire gives them a better feeling than sex, supposedly. Mm-hmm. So it's addictive, obviously. And for a while I was thinking, because it was written in 1993, I was thinking if she was writing sort of a metaphor about like the crack epidemic from that period, like a sort of like inner city destruction of.
That's interesting.
If possible, like
that. I mean, it's possible. I haven't read anything about that specifically, because I kind of had my own ideas about what the whole pyro situation might mean, and it was just kind of my guess, you know, in terms of the world that they were going through. And I was just thinking about, like, and you know, it seems to me like the whole thing about fire is almost kind of a theme throughout the book, you know? I mean, pyro is definitely a big part of it, but there's so much stuff that just like it burns down, right? And I was thinking, you know, maybe this fire and the representation of just like complete destruction and just kind of like starting over. And so that's kind of what I thought of is this idea of just like fire being something that just completely destroys and wipes everything out. And that's just kind of the state that everyone's in. Yeah.
I mean, yes, that's a good point, because, you know, Earthseed, which is the 15-year-old Lauren's burgeoning concept of God and religion, is based in change. I mean, she basically, in her journal diary entries, starts writing these poetic manifestations of this, it's not really a religion, but like a belief system. I can call it a religion, I guess. A belief system that God is change, mm-hmm. and that change prevails, that change is constant.
Right.
And that, but God can, as change, can be changed itself. You bring something to God as God brings to you. So that change can change you, and you can also change this concept of God. So it's more falling to the side of God is within one. Or not really. It's God is outside of you, in that it's the world around you is, if nothing else, changing.
And right.
To prevail, you have to survive. I mean, there's some great lines of Lauren's that she says, like, you know, survival is something like persistent, positive obsession.
So one of the things.
Oh, wait. One quick thing. Because I never interrupt you. persistent, the keyword persistent there, which is good, because she says later, without persistence, you just have momentary enthusiasm.
And yes.
That sort of shamed me for a minute, because I think I'm more that than persistent. She has courage to be persistent. So sorry. I'm sorry. Go.
No, I was just going to read this part that. And it's the opening of the book, and it's the kind of, it's a verse. So when you're reading the book, she has verses from this, I don't know if you want to call it like philosophy that she's written, but basically the main verse that she keeps coming back to, or that you kind of see repeated throughout the book, is all that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. And the only lasting truth is change. God is change. And I think what's interesting about kind of this new religion, and she writes it in her journal. Well, all of this is written in her journal. But basically, what's different from kind of her God and the God that you see from the other religions is that this God has no kind of specific feelings about you as an individual. So they don't love you. This God doesn't love you. This God doesn't hate you. This God doesn't judge you. The God is just change, and he has no specific loyalty to you, so it's kind of up to you to change God and to take care of yourself. And that's kind of the philosophy of her and how she makes the foundation of this community that she builds. So, you know, that theme going through that God is kind of what we make it.
Yeah, and at the core of it is this concept of change, which, as we all know, I mean, just by, you know, even working in an institution or a corporation or a job, like, you know, what do we talk about all the time? Well, change, you know, change is good and change is coming, but it's difficult to navigate. And it's something that comes up all the time. And what you said before about the pyros and the people who sort of take this drug or devolve into this chaos where they set fires that cause destruction, but they get pleasure out of it. And there's a lot of killing and there's a lot of chaos. I'm glad you read that part, because I wanted to have that said too. To me, the core of what happened is something that happens like around page 100, mm-hmm. which is also another philosophizing from Lauren's diary about this burgeoning earthseed religion she's creating. When she says that when apparent stability disintegrates, as it must, God is change. People tend to give in to fear and depression, to need and greed. When no influence is strong enough to unify people, they divide, they struggle. One against one, group against group, for survival, position, power. They remember old hates and generate new ones. They create chaos and nurture it. They kill and kill and kill until they are exhausted and destroyed, until they are conquered by outside forces, or until one of them becomes a leader, most will follow, or a tyrant most fear.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to 2020.
Yeah, exactly.
Or 2024 or 25.
In the book, right?
From the book.
So far off. Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting point about the idea of kind of like dividing and separating these groups, you know, and the fact that I feel like another big theme in this book is just the idea of a community and kind of how Lauren, I mean, I don't want to say like Jesus or something, mm-hmm. but kind of like as she's going on this journey, she kind of begins to pick up people and they begin to follow her. And she really begins to kind of like spread this idea and start this community, which is a theme actually across kind of all of Octavia Butler's books, But that kind of plays into it a little bit of what you were saying, but also, you know, it's reminding us of a lot of what's happening now.
I mean, because what happens is she lives in her community and that community is destroyed and her family killed, ostensibly. I have a feeling some might return in the second book, but as far as we know in the first book, her family is gone and she goes on this journey by herself on the road north, which also could be a slave metaphor in a way, like the journey north. Because what's interesting though is all of what we just said, in that Lauren is tall and she's strong. She's a 15-year-old black girl, and she has the ability, and this is what I said, I wish I had more of her qualities, is that she has the ability to see that the world has changed. There's a part in the book that says, it's only when plagues, and I think she uses the word plague or chaos is visited upon us, do most people then realize, oh, things change. Lauren sees change coming before a lot of people do. She senses it, and maybe because she sees the centrality of the concept of change and anticipates the possibility of change, whereas her family around her and people in her neighborhood are just like, oh, it'll be okay. We have a wall around us. And, you know, those crazy people are not going to get in. And they just want it to stay the same because they're frightened.
Right.
Or they are frightened for their loved ones, or they can only manage the status quo that has been, that has developed. Because they, again, don't understand, like Lauren does, that God is change. So things are going to change. And you have to be eternally vigilant. So what I said about her height and her strength is that she, part of that, if you want to break it down, because I think all of us can say, well, I can adapt, I'll be adaptable. And when I really think about it, I'm like, I don't know how adaptable I would be. Because one of the questions you can ask yourself in this book is, how would I survive? Would I survive?
Right.
She susses out the hierarchy, because she decides, I'm a woman, a young girl, alone, on the road, not good. I can't do that. I'll be raped. I'll be hurt. You know, I'll think God knows what could happen to me. And so she just dresses as a man, which I think is an interesting thing, because what that means to me is that she's looking and saying, okay, there's a hierarchy of power here. I've got good ideas, I think. I think I'm really going to survive because I'm going to do this. I've thought about it. I've put thought into it, which is an important ingredient, but I know what I must do then to get through it. Don't you find that interesting?
I do. I think, you know, she's kind of a visionary in terms of seeing what the future, I guess, is going to be like, but also reading this, I just thought that she had really incredible survival instincts. Like, she kind of had something within her that says, even though the world is going to, you know, the worst thing that it can possibly be, I can't say what I want to say, but she said, I am going to survive this. Like, that is her, feel like that's one of the things that drives her, is survival, because, you know, we get it from the very beginning that she plans for what's going to happen. She reads these books on how to, you know, grow certain foods and how to build things. And she makes a survival pack, and she, you know, she has a plan for how to actually survive outside of the walls. And I think Earthseed, her religion, is not just, you know, this philosophy of God, but it's another way of saying we're going to survive, because at some point humans aren't even going to be able to live on this earth anymore because we've destroyed it. So we're still going to survive because we'll just go to a different planet. So I think this whole thing that she has is just like these incredible, like, survival instincts and this drive to just like exist past all of these horrible things that are happening. And I think, and again, like, I think, like, would I be able to do that as well? I want to say yes, but, you know, we don't know.
I don't know. I honestly don't think I could. I would follow her because I think she'd be strong, and I sense that. I think I'd be smart enough to sense that, but I don't think I'd be the leader. I think I would follow her. But that is an interesting thing about how one is oneself and how one becomes oneself. Like you said, there's something in her that that forces her to prepare. Like she does. I mean, there's certain concepts that are illustrated by her actions, like her constant reading and her giving of books to her friends to say, read these books on plants and how to eat in the wild because you might need it to survive. Like her knowledge is power concept, and her preparing, like you said, a survival bag which would have something she could just grab and then be on the road and have enough to get her through. Right. Which, you know, who does that? Like, I don't. I certainly don't have a survival bag. I mean, and it seems like, oh, why would I? And maybe,
yeah,
you know, stores are mobbed when there's a disaster because
exactly. You know, things like those shows, you know, like the Doomsday Preppers, and you know, some of those, you know, people make fun of them or look down on them, but I'm sure like when the pandemic started, they probably had all the toilet paper they needed, you know? So again, it's kind of just her foresight, but even when they're in the community or she's kind of building up this community, she still makes these decisions kind of on her survival. You know, it's being out there, it's really dangerous being outside the walls. I mean, and you don't really know who to trust, but she understands that being in the group is more important than kind of just being with her and her two colleagues or her two friends. And so she begins to like include more people. And as she includes more people, she begins to kind of slowly like give them her philosophy. So I feel like that theme just kind of runs through the entire story as we just see her just have these ideas of how to live through these times.
Yeah. I mean, what about the other characters? Like her, I mean, like her father who disappears, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, much is made of when you go outside the walls of the community, because he's a professor as well at a university. So he does go and teach. So he does have to go out, but like a lot is made of, you know, if you don't have to go out of the walled community, then don't. Right. They're very subsistent with farming and selling each other goods. And even one household, like the last household, has a TV and they charge people to watch it. I mean, everyone makes money how they can. It's interesting that when I was reading, because it was written in 1993, it's like obviously no internet or cell phone yet.
Right.
And see how she, of course, nothing is made of that, except once she does refer to the father, I think, or Lauren's stepmother, that they are having a compu meeting.
Yes, yes.
Like a computer meeting on a computer, but like it's just a throwaway. And I was like, a compu meeting. I was like, you mean Skype or Zoom or whatever.
And I think even if she did make it when we had cell phones and all that kind of stuff, I feel like it wouldn't make a difference because it seems like everything kind of has stopped working.
Yeah, exactly.
There anyway. So it's like the TV, the one TV fails and they only have like kind of transistor radios. And,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. But so like, you know, that's why I thought it was sort of like a metaphor. I mean, it's interesting putting my own, you know, interpretation on something that might not exist, like this sort of city in turmoil where her brother also leaves the community and gets horribly killed. And then her father disappears. I was thinking about male influences in her life, like are being pulled away. Mm. And also her, like I said, she has a stepmother because her mother was an addict who died when she was little or barely, you know, born. So she's very much like on her own, like all these figures of authority or love or support are taken away from her, even though she does not agree with her father as a philosophically, who's a minister, and she doesn't say it. She has the strength of mind to love him, but also know she disagrees with his philosophy, but they have a good relationship.
Right.
And so then she pitched into one chaotic night, you know, the whole community is destroyed and pitched into on the road north, like this sort of concept of going north, mm-hmm. with a vague hope that there's jobs or opportunity or, you know, a sanctuary.
Right.
Oh, but then you're right. She does say her ultimate goal, which was vague at first. Like, I didn't quite take it literally, like, to live among the stars. Like, she has this concept of living out off this planet. Like, this planet's done. Like,
yeah, that's good. That's it. And again, like, I won't talk too much about it, but that plays a much bigger factor in the second book in terms of
right
space.
Well, I mean, nothing in the first book indicates like she's going to build a spaceship or anything. I mean, like, you have no clue how that's going to work. I mean, it's not really made, I think, too much of. It's a goal which you feel is, you know, could be realistic, because anything in a forward future set book can be realistic. Don't know what might come by, but
and also,
she's having a journey. Yeah,
that her idea of among the stars isn't one that's immediate. She's kind of thinking maybe like generations down the line, but that this, her philosophy will kind of prepare people for that. But one of the things I think kind of in terms of science fiction-y, I guess, and that I was thinking about was maybe, you know, Lauren is kind of this evolved human. And one of the things that I thought about that was, you spoke about her mother, and her mother was an addict of a certain drug, and this drug caused Lauren to have this syndrome called hyperempathy syndrome, which means, you know, she can share other people's pain and she can also share other people's pleasure. And even when she was a girl, sometimes if other people would bleed, she would even bleed.
Yeah.
And as you see, it's something that is a vulnerability for her, because there's so much violence in the world that if she sees some violence, she's going to feel it. But she refers to it, or someone refers to it in the book, as a biological conscience, which I thought was a really, really interesting way to look at it, that your body kind of will tell you what's good or what's bad. And the idea that if everyone had this hyperempathy syndrome, then no one would want to cause each other pain. So I was thinking in that way, maybe she's kind of evolved, not just kind of in her thinking, but physically as well.
That's really, I'm glad you, of course, brought that up, because it's a big part of it. And it's, her hyperempathy is almost looked upon as a disability.
Right.
She hides it. So there's that element too, about what is it to be so-called disabled in society. But what I really like about that hyper-empathy thing is that Octavia Butler makes it very, not complicated, but multidimensional, and that it's easy to say, oh, she has empathy. And what do we talk about, of course, a lot these days too, is like, we must have more empathy. But it's not just, you know, feeling someone else's pain. I mean, because she feels that pain, and it's mostly pain, occasionally in there are scenes where she feels the other person's pleasure, which is sort of an interesting scene, but she feels their pain. I think that directly goes into her personality of God has changed, in that she can see so clearly that everyone around her is as human as she is, that they're as human and biological as she is, that she can then almost not attach too much emotional connection to them, in beyond the fact that we're all brethren and in this together kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Maybe I'm not saying that right, because it also, what her hyperempathy directly in terms of skill gives her is that she can kill much more lethally, because
right.
She realizes, yeah, if she doesn't kill, if she's in a situation where it's kill or be killed, she has to kill them so clearly, because if they suffer too much, she suffers. Like, if she stabs someone or shoots someone and they die slowly, she's feeling it too. So
right.
She's out of commission. So like, if they're on the ground dying, she's on the ground in pain as they are until they die, and then it's done. Mm-hmm. She also doesn't know, like, am I going to die with them? Because she hadn't, as a 15-year-old girl, didn't kill anybody, and then she has to. And she realizes, interestingly, because of that, she has to actually kill carefully and cleanly.
Right. And she's not afraid to do it either. You know, she doesn't hesitate, again, right, kind of going to her whole idea of just, you know, surviving through all of this, you know, knowing that that can take her out. And she does run into a few other people. Some other people join her group that also, or I guess like the colloquial term for hyper empathy syndrome is a sharer. Mm-hmm. So there are other people who are sharers in her group who also hide it. And the interesting thing is I think that the people who were also sharers were people who were running from this modern day slavery, this debt slavery that you were speaking of. And she was saying how that was something that that was appealing to those people who kind of enslaved other people, because they knew that it would be much easier for them to control if they knew that these people were sharers. So right. The danger and the vulnerability they have kind of living in this world is even worse than if it were modern day, you know, like how we live now, to have this kind of hyper empathy syndrome, because people will use it to enslave them, use it against them. So that kind of just adds an extra layer to who she is, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this whole concept, I mean, because it's such a concept of thought we have now about what empathy is and why we need to have it. I didn't say it right before, but there's something there that's not just like this sort of sentimental, like I feel what you feel, so we're all in it together. There's something else there about this, because you just said having this hyper empathy, people can use it against you. So if it's known, it has to be actually kept quiet. Because as she encounters other people along the road, she realizes some of them are also sharers like she is. I don't know. Do you hear that drilling?
Only a little bit, you know. But it's right. You know, look at it as a sign of progress. Things are moving along.
All right. You know? I'm just glad. Sorry. This like just life is going on. All right. Anyway, let me see.
Let's see. I think
I'm looking at my notes.
I want to know, how do you feel? And I feel like I really like this, but reading books that are in diary format. I mean, one of the things about it is that, one, I feel like we really get to understand and know who Lauren Olamina is. But I also feel that with this format, we are really, really only getting a very certain viewpoint of what's happening. And I think that Octavia Butler might have done this on purpose, because I don't think that we are, I feel like she has made Lauren purposely kind of very imperfect. And I think one of the things that she had wrote in an interview that she wrote was that she gave Lauren the middle name Oya, because that's the name of a deity of the Niger River. And she said, Oya means that she's unpredictable, she's intelligent, and she's and it's dangerous. Uh-huh. So I'm thinking, because, you know, some of the things I think about in terms of kind of like Earthseed and everything is like, okay, is this a really forward-thinking religion, or is this going to turn into some kind of cult? Like, is this going to become some kind of, you know, I don't know, other things that we think of, other religions that we think of out there. I won't name any specific ones that are considered like cults nowadays. So is she this really like great visionary who's going to change the world, or is she going to turn into something like a little bit more dangerous as she grows and gets more power? So I don't know. I kind of thought of all of that when I'm thinking about reading this diary from a very specific point of view. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Frank.
Do you hear that?
I do hear that.
Sorry. They just set off the fire alarm. That's interesting, because if you look at what the title is, The Parable of the Sower, which is the sort of story from the Bible of a farmer planting seed, some land on stone and don't grow, some are eaten by birds, and some take root. Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I felt like I liked, and it felt non-culty to me, and that I liked that it was really a sort of live and let live, but always try to survive. And some will work, some won't work, some will take you on a different road, but you still persist, and you still positively, obsessively persist. And I sort of think that's sort of pretty logical in some ways, and and admirable. And you said before too about how this going to the star, her goal of going to the stars was very much in the future. I also like that about Lauren, and that part of this philosophy is not about necessarily the result, because there is no result. Like she says, even stable societies will crumble or change. That is a given. Her mm-hmm. her goal is to survive and to persist. And it sounds like this is probably the problem, a depressing life, because it's like, well, it's all about just like surviving or persisting and no like material goal or, I've made it, then what's the point of living? But once she accepts so much, or it's so much a part of her that changes everything, that's mm-hmm. just the core for her. So the survival itself, it's not about happy or not happy or getting or not getting. It's about persistent forward motion and decision. There's a line that says belief, which you could say religion or philosophy or any kind of worldview, belief initiates and guides action, or right. it is nothing at all. So belief, if it's not about guiding action or initiating action, is nothing, which is pretty strong. But that parable of the sower, like, is persuasive in that it is like some things are not going to work. I mean, it does seem, and that's Octavia Butler's choice, that you could say the happenstance of Lauren's life does abet her survival. But Octavia Butler's writing about a woman who's going to survive and a woman who's going to be a leader. There's no question about that. She's going to go about her business and do what she needs to do. And, you know, nothing's going to get in her way, which is good, is an admirable thing, right?
It is. But here's the thing, and I think that reading that quote about why she named her Oya, that she's intelligent, unpredictable, and dangerous, is because, and I think this adds an exciting element to the book and to the writing, is that you kind of think, you know, someone who is so driven and their purpose is survival, kind of, you know, what are the limits? You know, how far is she willing to go? And then also you can see that she's kind of this natural born leader as well. And the religion, I think towards the end of the book, you begin to see that the people who can stay with her and the people who can live in this community are the people who believe what she believes. They, you know, kind of has to adhere to what Earthsea is. And so that's just kind of making me think, you know, think about her as a much more kind of complex person. And yeah, and she definitely has really admirable elements and qualities, but also thinking about like what kind of leader is she going to become, what type of qualities and are she going to develop, and what else, you know, as a leader of this group is going to happen so that they can survive. And I think that's something that is what makes Lauren a much more interesting character, kind of having those questions out there.
Well, I see your point, because, you know, like with anything, she has to make judgments. She has to kill when she feels like she's in danger. I mean, she does have a moral guideline that, you know, she won't kill someone just to get what's in their pockets, like some people are doing, like a lot of people are doing.
Right.
She does have that moral compass, but you're right, because any belief system, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, eventually, if it gets big enough, it does seem to sort of devolve into some form of corruption. Mm-hmm. She does have this element where she, and it's said frequently when she starts telling people about her Earthseed philosophy, she's, you know, their reaction is like, oh, please. You know, she has a very varied reactions. And she also makes it clear, like, I'm not trying to proselytize, but, you know, or she tries to say it in a way that's like not going to scare someone, that it's like, I'm imposing a belief on you and I'm a crazy cult person.
Right.
But yet you're right. If she's as she is a leader, well, you'd know because you read the second book, but like what happens when someone does attain power, you'd have to be even stronger to make sure it doesn't corrupt, doesn't turn you corrupt. You know? Is that what you were saying?
I think, yeah, I think that's definitely a part of it. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why I really like the book. Mm. Is because I feel like there are a lot of questions out there about, you know, we're seeing such a narrow viewpoint from her diary that, you know, kind of just wondering, you know, what is she going to become? How are these other people really viewing her? You know, how is she going to really make Earthseed what she wants it to be in terms of keeping this community with her?
You know, I think that Octavia Butler did this, now that you say that, because she didn't want this woman to be viewed through any other lens but her own. She mm-hmm. didn't want it to be viewed through a class lens or a race lens or a gender lens. This was a strong individual who was going to manifest. And I think Octavia Butler did not want anything to get into that way. She didn't want to have to filter it right. And probably refused to have to explain her, explain what made her what she is, what she's doing. She just was this girl who was going to triumph, was going to achieve. And I didn't quite think of it that way until you just said what you said. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty great, actually.
It could be. And I feel like that's what I thought when I was reading it. And I thought that's what made it. And again, like, you could be correct, like, just not having to view her through other lenses, mm-hmm. but also these questions about who she is. I don't know.
Because none of the things, like I even mentioned, she tries to pass as a man for a while. Like, none mm-hmm. of the things like gender, race, class, money, really come into it for too long. What persists, again, with that word, is her brain, her ideology, her philosophy. That's what makes her, not all the other stuff. That it's not made much of, all the other stuff.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And that's pretty revolutionary, pretty cool, actually.
It's very cool.
I just realized how much I like that, and I didn't realize it when I was reading it until now, talking about it with you.
Of course. Very cool. I think it is.
Wow.
I think that's what's one of the cool things about this book. And to me, I just think it gives me so much extra stuff to kind of to think about. Even having read the second book, you know, I still think about kind of what does it take to start a new religion? Like, you have to have a very powerful person at the head, right? To really be totally committed to these ideals. And what does it mean to be totally committed to these ideals that you have created, and how to keep this group who believes these ideals, and you know, just kind of what type of person does it take to do that, and what type of world does it take to kind of have other people believe this, you know? So,
I mean,
the other people, who are kind of falling in line with this, like, is it because there's nothing else out there for them, you know? Like, this is it? I don't know. It's a lot to...
I mean, it's that element of belief. Like, as I was reading it, like, you know, she does accept certain people to walk with her, to continue on the road north with her. And she makes alliances, but I was watching carefully to see how she does that, and I realized it's really just a crapshoot, in that it's like a judgment call, like we all have to make, and it just turns out that, you know, Lauren's choices are good ones for the most part. But like, I was thinking, if I were on my own and like had a gun, and everyone has to have a gun so you don't get destroyed, because if you have a gun, that means you can fight back. I mean, and then someone comes into your area and they're walking with you, and you're just like completely don't trust them, and Lauren doesn't. Like, what makes you eventually accept them? You just go by your guts, your instinct. And that's what I meant. Like, I'd follow her rather than be the leader, because I don't think I have that good of an instinct. I really don't. I mean, I think when it came down to it, I don't know. I don't think it would end well for me, unfortunately.
I don't know. I feel like it's hard to say. I feel like she didn't even... She believed that she could survive, but yeah. I think there's also the idea of, like, no one really knows until, like, herself, how she was put outside the walls, right? You know, she had a plan, but you can't really plan for what's going to happen.
Yeah, and she knows that.
Situations. And luckily, you know, again, as part of the story, she was able to connect early with people from her own community. So she had those people, and then kind of figuring out who to trust. And again, the people who kind of joined her group were very vulnerable people. You know, she had the couple that had a baby with them, so they were vulnerable. She, the two sisters who had ran away from a very abusive father, the couple that had escaped from slavery. So these people that she chose or that kind of joined her group were already like in really coming from really, really dire situations, and everyone was. But these people who kind of came in were, I felt, especially vulnerable and probably especially susceptible to be open to these types of beliefs.
Oh. And you do see it as a cult, don't you? I know you're questioning it, but you seem to be drifting there.
I'm drifting towards cult-like.
Wow.
But I think that's okay. I think that that's interesting.
Okay.
To think about, to see it from a different point of view. But, you know, that's the kind of people that possibly that would be more open to joining the community. And because they need, not only do they maybe like the idea of Earthseed, but also they kind of need that group.
Yeah.
You know, they need the protection when they find the land in the end. I mean, where else are they going to go? Where else do they have land and a group of people who are going to protect them and some options, you know? Like, again, like you said, like, you would follow her. Maybe I would too, but I don't know if I would follow her because of Earthseed. Maybe I would follow her because that's the best option. So, and again, I actually don't remember a whole too much from the second book, but I'm wondering if this happened, if there were people who where that comes out, you know? Like, people were, maybe people don't feel so strongly about Earthsea, but they like the idea of having this protection and having this group.
Absolutely. And that's sort of, you know, Octavia Butler says that about that out of fear and need, you sometimes don't make the best choices, that you have to really be thoughtful and you have to really think, use the brain as far as it's evolved for us, that can help you make the best choice rather than making it purely out of need and fear, which I think is what you're sort of saying, which can attract people to cults. And I think Lauren's burgeoning cult is not so much, is a cult only in the loosest sense, is that because Lauren is not a manipulator and she's not an abuser. And she even says, like, people do not have to believe what I say. It's happening organically, which can maybe set an alarm off, but it's happening organically. But you were a bit mentioning the other characters. Like, what about the man that she eventually has intimacy with?
Bencole.
Basically the age of her father. She's 18.
Exactly.
And he's like 57. Like, what is that about? I thought it was fine. She's 18. He's 57. Mm-hmm. He's a nice guy. she wants it. Like, that's an interesting thing. Like, because they made up something, Octavia Butler makes something of the fact that he's the same age as her father.
Right.
I was like, what? What?
I don't know. You know, I feel like there's a lot there. Mm. You know, maybe her maturity level is that of, so that she would not mesh well with someone who's in her age range, you know? Mm. Maybe that's part of it. Or maybe she sees, again, with her whole idea of survival, maybe she sees him as safe, that someone who can keep her and help her stay safe. I don't know. There's a lot of things that can be said about the age.
She needs someone as smart as her.
She needs someone as smart as her. They do seem to have, you know, they had some things in common that they mentioned in terms of, like, their families and the names that they were given. And, you know, I can't remember, I don't know why this is slipping my mind, how he felt about Earthsea. He seemed to be more resistant than the others in the group to her ideas.
He was more like a... like I was going to say comically dismissive. It wasn't comic, but it was more like I've been around the block. I'm an older guy. But what he basically says is like, I don't know about the God stuff, but yeah, I guess, yeah, obviously change is part of life. And he's sort of like looking at it more prosaically, whereas she's looking at it much more like this is the core of everything.
Yeah.
And he's a little dismissive, but it's lovingly dismissive. He's sort of like, you're smart. Like it. Maybe it's interesting if Octavia is saying, you know, an 18-year-old Lauren needs a person who's been through a lot of life, because Lauren really has mm-hmm. the sort of wisdom of an older person, or potential older, you know,
right.
Hopefully we're wiser, more older. 'Cause it never really seemed strange. It seemed like a good match.
It does, yeah. It seems, I mean, we know of the age range or age difference, but she doesn't seem to discuss it that much in the book. And I don't know, maybe in a situation that they're in with the rest of the world just, you know, destroyed, maybe that kind of thing isn't that important anymore. You know, it's...
Well, because there is Harry, the guy from her neighborhood who's her age, and eventually... You know, Harry's gets with Zara, who's a girl from the neighborhood. They're all around the same age.
Yeah.
I think she's definitely saying about something about Lauren's power, that her capabilities are on par with a mature man.
Mm. I think that's a good point. I definitely, yeah.
Get out of my way. Get out of my way. I guess. There's, yeah, it can be brutal, the book. So if anyone wants to read it, it's, there's definitely brutal asides on what the landscape of the world looks like. And I found it harsh sometimes, just like you mentioned cannibalism before. Some of those images are pretty hard. I mean, anyway, yeah. It reminded me of The Road by Cormac McCarthy. Only glancingly. I mean, they both have similar plots of like moving on a road towards hopeful, you know, something hopeful in an apocalyptic landscape. But there the comparisons really end in a way.
Yeah. And the cannibalism.
Yeah.
Role in both books.
Which, yeah, I guess is an indicator of dystopia that, you know,
exactly.
People will do that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's not pleasant.
I know. That's not a
good note to end on.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe you didn't want to end on the cannibalism.
I know, there's
but
so much. I don't know. It does so end with question, the... Go ahead.
Are you going to move forward and read the Parable of the Talents?
I sort of do. I mean, I wanted to read also The Changeling, the book you talked about before. Like,
yes.
So many on my list... It's one of those, and I just have to calm down and not feel guilty about it.
Really fast. I don't know if you felt the same way, but I felt like I got through this book really quickly. Maybe it's the format, but I kind of felt like it just flew by.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, her writing is surges. It keeps you going, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's why it doesn't matter how many pages it is. I mean, it's about 300 pages, but it's about how you engage with it and how it's written. I mean, you know, if you write book at the right time too, it can keep you going through it. And it's like, didn't matter if it was 300, 400, 500 pages. It's not about length. It's about the writing. And also if your brain is taps into that writing at that moment. Not every book, you might love a book at one point, but not so much at another.
Yeah.
But I agree.
And kind of going back to the circle, yeah, the fact that so many people are reading this now.
I know.
And that's like, I think this was her first time ever on the New York Times bestseller list. You know.
Yeah. I mean, after her death too, I know. Oh, did you know that, well, you have to have, but did you remember? Because I read this, that in the sequel, Parable of the Talents, that the president that's alluded to in the first one, President Donner, who's the president who sort of unites religion and government, and, you know, it was just not a nice guy. His presidential slogan is "Make America Great Again."
I did actually not remember that. I wonder.
Well, she wrote that in 1998. The sequel to Harry Potter and Sower. So I was like, "What?" And then I actually remembered that Ronald Reagan in the 80s had a slogan called "Let's Make America Great Again."
Okay,
so this was in the 90s. So Octavia Butler was probably hearkening to Reagan time. And even Clinton, I think, used like "Make America Great Again" to some degree in his campaign, or possibly. But it's not new for now, but yet it's turned into something much more and bigger than it ever was.
Yeah.
But I thought Octavia Butler couldn't have been that prescient.
I know, that would have been, or unless someone from the campaign was reading Octavia Butler, which I highly doubt.
And actually, if somebody from the campaign was reading Octavia Butler, that would make it tragic to the core, because it's a dystopic, terrible regime. And if they were going to take a terrible regime's name, that would just be the end of hope.
Exactly.
Oh.
There's another nice note that we could end on.
Oh, do you think we should actually say that this is going to be, you know, really, we're recording this before the election, but it's going to be out after the election?
Yes, that might be important.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because we're recording this and it won't be released till after the results are in. So actually, the book might be needed by people just as a primer of how to survive.
Oh boy.
Geez. Oh, I guess we can't not end depressed.
Yeah, I feel like, well,
this is terrible.
You know, the idea, I guess, there is hope, because that's what Earthseed is that, you know, that the idea that even when Earth is completely destroyed, there is still hope for humans in outer space.
Okay, and you reminded me that another comment in the book is hope is active.
There you go.
So whatever happens, whatever change, whatever occurs, one can hope, but turn that hope into action. There we go.
Great point.
Thank you, Octavia Butler.
Yes, thank you, Octavia.
And I'm so glad I read it. I read Kindred, but I'm glad I read Parable of the Sower. And she's a very interesting lady. I'm glad that she existed.
Yes, absolutely.
And wrote.
Her writing is, yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. So Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler. The sequel, Parable of the Talents by Octavia Butler.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So
all right.
See you on the other side, everybody. See what happens. And I'll see you soon too, Rhonda.
I'll see you soon.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library and our 125th anniversary, please visit nypl.org/125. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Calarius and Rhonda Evans.